This is Ben Grauer with the news to now. A new military reserve bill with the ban on race segregation deleted has been introduced in the House by Representative Carl Ranson of Georgia. The chairman of the House Armed Service Committee says his measure is aimed at building a military reserve force of nearly 3 million men. Vinson has called his committee together tomorrow to consider the legislation labeled a must by the Eisenhower administration. And the Georgia Democrat says he expects quick approval, maybe tomorrow. A previous bill has been stalled in the House Rules Committee because of a clause written in by Vinson's group to bar race segregation in the National Guard and some other military units. And the House has passed a bill giving more than 1 million rank-and-file government workers a 7.5% pay raise. The vote was 370-3. The measure now goes to a Senate House conference to compromise the House figure with a 10% raise voted by the Senate. The United Nations' 10th birthday meeting opens in San Francisco later today. President Eisenhower will address the session. Some diplomats believe his speech will have special significance in view of the forthcoming Chiefs of State Conference in Geneva less than a month from now on July 18th. Diplomatic sources in San Francisco also believe Russia's Foreign Minister Molotov will press for a UN anniversary declaration, perhaps in the form of a resolution for peace. However, under the present procedure rules, the anniversary session is supposed merely to hear speeches on the United Nations record and not to make decisions of any kind. Immediately following this newscast, NBC brings us a special broadcast from San Francisco on the UN meeting. Stay tuned for this special report on the United Nations. Striking stevedores in the Port of London have voted to end their dock walkout and return to work tomorrow. Similar moves are expected in other ports later today. But the wildcat strike by Britain's seamen continues to interfere seriously with transatlantic service. The seamen, most of them stewards and kitchen hands, are demanding shorter working hours and better conditions. The nation's number one steel producer, the United States Steel Corporation, has announced in Pittsburgh it will make its wage increase offer to the CIO Steelworkers Union later this week. Company Vice President John Stevens said of the forthcoming wage increase proposal, we quote now, "We hope it will result in a speedy and mutual settlement of our negotiations." Argentina's President Perón may be about to take a secondary role in the leadership of his country. According to reports reaching the outside world, the army, headed by General Franklin Lucero, is negotiating with Perón and Navy leaders to set up a three-man junta. In the meantime, General Lucero is described as going ahead with efforts to return Argentina to normal. The general came into prominence after his troops rescued Perón's government in Thursday's Navy revolt. The President of the United States has requested that the Senate confirm the promotion of the retiring Army Chief of Staff, General Matthew Ridgway, to permanent four-star rank. Ridgway, a major general, has held temporary rank as a full general in his capacity as Chief of Staff. He'll be succeeded in that post on June 30th by General Maxwell Taylor, former Far East Commander. The 900,000 streetcar and bus riders in Los Angeles are without service today, the result of a strike for higher pay by some 2,600 AFL transportation workers. The union rejected a negotiating committee suggestion that the walkout be delayed until Thursday. 8,000 prison guards throughout France have staged a 24-hour sit-in strike on the grounds that convicts get a better deal than they do. Some guards earn as little as $71 a month, while convicts working in prison for private firms get as much as $114 a month. The guards also want better uniforms and shorter hours. Their stoppage gave little comfort to prisoners. During the strike, prisons were shut tighter than before, and no one could get in or out. Well, a burglar who broke into a lumber company's office at Orlando, Florida, got precious little in loot, but he left behind a musical clue, a dictaphone record of the unsuccessful burglar singing Davy Crockett. There's the news to now. I'll be back again at 3 p.m. tomorrow. Till then, this is Ben Grauer saying goodbye.
Today, hear the UN 10th anniversary program over most NBC radio stations.
This is Pauline Frederick in the NBC booth in the War Memorial Opera House here in San Francisco. A little later in the auditorium just below, the UN General Assembly will convene in special session to commemorate the 10th anniversary of the signing of the UN Charter. President Eisenhower will be the first speaker. Each day, beginning tomorrow, the heads of 15 delegations, including one of the big four foreign ministers, will make statements of policy. Each day at this time, too, NBC Radio will bring you highlights of those sessions with comment by NBC commentators H.V. Kaltenborn, Bill Henry, Chet Huntley, Elmer Peterson, and myself. Everything is in readiness down there in the auditorium. The flags of the 60 member nations massed against the blue backdrop. The gold chairs in place for the three officers, President Van Kleffens of the Netherlands, Secretary General Hammarskjöld, and Assistant Secretary Cordier. The speaking rostrum just below, the red plush seats on the floor marked off in delegation groups. As we await the opening of this historic session, this is a time for reminiscence, for evaluation of hopes realized or disappointed in the past 10 years, even speculation as to what is ahead. Joining me in this discussion are three of my colleagues who were here in 1945 also, and who have followed the development of the United Nations through the past 10 years. They will be bringing you through this week the important diplomatic developments here in San Francisco. Their voices and names are known to radio listeners from coast to coast.
This is H.V. Kaltenborn.
This is Bill Henry. Mrs. Chet Huntley.
And now that we are all identified, suppose we start the discussion. First, I suppose it's natural to take a look backward in contrast or comparison with the present, the outward differences or similarities with this United Nations conference and the conference in 1945. Hans, would you like to start off the discussion?
Well, of course, these 10 years have been tumultuous, history-making, disappointing. I suppose most people really thought, I know they did here at San Francisco, that this was the new United Nations, which, better than the League of Nations, would keep the peace of the world. Well, it hasn't done it. There have been several minor wars since. I wasn't optimistic to that extent because I'd followed the birth, the growth, development, and death of the League of Nations. And I knew that an organization of this kind expresses the hopes of the world, not necessarily its possibilities of practical accomplishment. So I feel that the United Nations has done about as well as anyone had any right to expect. It has not done as well as the optimists expected, but it has done far better than the pessimists who predicted it would accomplish nothing at all. It has done a great deal. It has had a comparatively successful first 10 years, just as the League of Nations had. And the question in my mind is, what will the second decade bring? That perhaps we'll have a chance to talk about a little later.
Yes, you've given us a lot of material there to go into specifically a little later. Now, let's ask Bill Henry how he contrasts or compares this United Nations meeting with the one in 1945.
Well, I think it is very much as H.V. has said. I think that people have sort of cooled off. In other words, they don't expect quite as much now as they did 10 years ago. Of course, I agree with him that those of us who were close to the thing 10 years ago were cooled off very quickly because we'd scarcely gotten to San Francisco before the trouble arose with the Russians and the discovery that they'd thrown the whole Polish cabinet into the clink in Moscow and so on. And we very quickly made our minds up that things were not going to go as smoothly as we had hoped. I think now people are looking at the United Nations a little more calmly and a little more sanely, and I agree very much with H.V. that it has accomplished everything that sane people really had any right to expect, and we can look forward to greater accomplishments in the next 10 years because the approach is more realistic than it was.
I think it's rather interesting that the one major foreign minister who is returning to the United Nations scene here in San Francisco is Soviet Foreign Minister Molotov. And as you referred to some of the trouble he caused the other time, we are now wondering whether this will be a repeat performance or whether the new policy will be in operation. Well, Chet, what do you say about the present with 19 as compared with 1945?
Well, this business of interest is difficult to measure, and I would certainly agree with what Hans and Bill have said. There isn't a tremendous stir and the tremendous interest. I suppose, however, that if the UN had had a perfect batting record over the past decade, there would still be some letdown in the stir and interest and enthusiasm. And it also might indicate that the UN has come into a degree of acceptability, that the people look upon it as a more or less permanent organization and that it's here and here to stay. One other thing occurs to me. It was our State Department, you know, who was in charge here in 1945. Now it's the United Nations, giving us our credentials and attending to all the thousand and one things. One other small thing occurs to me, too. Remember last in 1945, Bill and Hans, there was great to-do about the small nations, and the small nations had great champions, Masaryk and particularly Evatt of Australia. Those men are gone. Who are the spokesmen for the small nations today, and is it even an issue?
Well, of course, the small nations have really had a better shake in the United Nations than they ever got in the League of Nations. League was dominated from the beginning by the big European powers. This idea of granting representation to smaller peoples, which was enunciated first perhaps by Woodrow Wilson, had not yet penetrated. Now it has penetrated. And I was struck with the fact that in the front row here today, who are the countries? Every one of them a small country. New Zealand, Pakistan, what were some of the others? Paraguay.
Panama.
Panama. All small countries, and they have their rights absolutely developed. And they are playing a more important part in the United Nations and have played for the past 10 years than they ever played in the league.
But Hans, would you agree with me on this point, that even though the small nations are having a little more opportunity to express themselves, we are not going to have peace or an effective United Nations unless the big powers themselves work together, which means that they are the ones who are the controlling factors in the world situation. The little powers may talk, the little nations may talk, but it's what the big powers do working together or in opposition with one another that will determine what's ahead.
Power is still the definite ultimo ratio.
Yes.
Nothing but power. However, there is a moral atmosphere surrounding the smaller nations today, which was not evident 10 years ago. And I think when we listen to President Eisenhower this afternoon, what can he say but emphasize the moral factors that are involved in this organization? And those moral factors mean that you've got to give the smaller nation their full rights. That's a thing that wasn't evident 10 years ago.
Yes, H.V., though, don't you think that over the period of time that the representatives of the smaller nations, while they have not had the authority to exert and don't carry the weight, nevertheless, their opinions and their voices have been very definitely heard. And it seems to me that on such occasions as the first one, when the United Nations took a strong stand against the Russian aggression in the northern part of Iran, that it was some of the spokesmen for the smaller nations, particularly, you remember the man from Iran,
made a tremendous impression.
And it seems to me that in that way, the theory of the United Nations as a place in which the voices of all could be heard has worked out very well.
Well, in other words, what we're talking about is a more or less of a change in the concept of the United Nations. In other words, instead of being an organization that relies on military power to carry out its decisions, it's tending more and more to become an organization which develops public opinion and moral force. Would that seem to be flowing from what we've been saying?
Yes, for two reasons. I think one indication is what I would call maybe a loss of prestige on the part of the Security Council and an increase of prestige by the General Assembly.
Very good point.
And number two, I think there is more backroom diplomacy in the UN today than there was in its early years, and particularly immediately after its founding. I don't think the UN conducts itself in a glass bowl as much today as it did 10 years ago.
In other words, it's not quite the town meeting so much as the machinery for private diplomacy. There's more emphasis on diplomacy.
Both. I think that the machinery for private diplomacy, for example, in ending the Korean War, that played a larger part in the United Nations than it played in the League of Nations. But you brought up something that I think is worth discussing for a bit, Bill. The contrast between the Molotov of 45 and the 55, because there you have the very heart of the success or failure of the United Nations. Now, in 45, as we all remember, Molotov was completely belligerent, non-cooperative. As you mentioned, this Polish thing, the Poles that had been arrested, and I remember Eden's very fascinating press conference in which he just went after the Russians.
Yes,
tongues,
that's right.
Hammering tongs. And there was that definite feeling against the Soviet Union. Now, this time, Molotov comes along and he's all smiles. He's a different man. He's carried himself from the moment of his arrival in a way that suggests a definite decision on the part of the Kremlin to make this a peace offensive. And I look forward not to the same Molotov that we had here 10 years ago, but to an entirely different Molotov. And there, I feel, is our chance for really getting at this work of organizing the world for peace.
But isn't that one of the problems, HV, that faces the organizers and leaders in this conference, is that they have to be prepared for both Molotovs. They have to be prepared for the fact that he might possibly be as belligerent and tough as he was 10 years ago, and they might be thrown completely off guard by this dove of peace aspect that he's been showing lately.
A goodly outside, rotten at the heart. That's what I'm afraid of.
Which means he's the center of attraction in 1955 as he was in 1945. He probably has...
And that's inevitable because he represents the greatest power that so far has been devoted to aggression and that has opposed every aspect of the United Nations. And if we can get a change there, then we can go forward with this organization on the basis that the Charter appoints. And without it, it's going to be difficult.
Are you saying, in effect, Hans, that if a peace offensive is underway, that this is no reason why we should be timid about it, that we can easily outstrip the Soviet Union? If it's a contest for peace, if it's a race for peace, or a peace offensive, we certainly should be able to do more than hold our own.
Well, I'm sure that as we will analyze the speech of the President of the United States and contrast it, as we will later this week, with the speech of Molotov, we'll probably find that the President has been concrete in what he has promised, and that Molotov is vague in what he promises. And that's the thing that we've got to look out for. It's the old story, not words, but deeds are what count from the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that one subject that will determine whether or not we're going to have a new policy from Russia, which will mean new cooperation in the UN, has to do with China. The representation of China, because certainly if the Soviet Union decides to champion the communist China and the United States decides to continue its policy of opposition to representation of communist China here, you're going to be back on your old deadlock among the big powers, which means that the UN again will not have any more chance to be effective than it has in the past.
Pauline, you're not suggesting for a moment that we should admit Red China.
I didn't suggest that.
I think we must always say, right at the beginning of any talk of this kind, is that China is represented.
Yes.
The one government that has some semblance of action by the people in its creation is represented in the United Nations and has been. The other government is a government that achieved its power by the exercise of force with the aid of the Soviet Union in continued acts of aggression. And there is no evidence whatever that the Red Government of China represents the people of China. As a matter of fact, it has engaged in aggression against the United Nations. It has fought them. It is still technically at war with them. And until that situation is changed, is eliminated, I don't think that any self-respecting nation can advocate the admission of Red China to the United Nations.
Well, Hans, I think we come here to an interpretation, probably varied interpretation, of the purposes of the UN. It seems to me that the Charter is rather clear that the purpose of the UN is to set up a machinery for preventing war. And in that respect, quite a number of UN...
May I challenge you right there?
Yes.
I don't think that its primary purpose is to prevent war. I think its primary purpose is to secure the cooperation of nations in order to make war less likely.
Yes, well,
Let's
I think
be
that's
practical.
I think that's a much better statement of it. But with that in mind, there are quite a number of officials of the UN and a number of heads of important delegations who feel that you cannot possibly carry out this purpose unless you open the UN to all nations. There should be a universality of membership here.
Including the 21
Spain,
that have been kept out
right,
by
Spain
the Soviet Union.
That's right, Spain and the rest of them. That it isn't up to the UN to decide whether a government is in control of an area. I mean, whether it is a good government, but whether or not it's in control of an area.
But doesn't the war that the United Nations has had to fight against Red China change that situation?
Well, it changes that, but then you come to the question of whether a sinner can ever repent.
Well, let him repent, and I'm willing to receive him into the kingdom.
I think that the same thing holds true at this session that held true 10 years ago, Pauline. It seems to me that the whole history of the first 10 years of the United Nations was forecast by the behavior of the various governments here in 1945. For instance, we came here with the idea that Stettinius was going to be the chairman for the entire procedure, and immediately the Russians insisted on rotation, or at least on equal representation. You had that thing come up. Then we all remember, we saw the downfall of Czechoslovakia right here in front of us when Jan Masaryk, who is known to all of us and who is known to be a liberal and a fine fellow, head to kowtow and take his hat off and bow around and follow the lead of Molotov for the simple reason that his whole country was in jeopardy. And the downfall of Czechoslovakia was just as plain as a nose on your face in that first week. So my theory is that possibly, as Hansen suggested, by the behavior not only of Molotov, but of some of the other people, maybe India, about whom there's some question, their behavior here may forecast the tide of events in the next 10 years.
Of course, I remember particularly that Molotov had us in a dither all the time.
Yes,
in fact, he had us so worked up that once when he got up from his seat and went out, everybody called it a Russian walkout. Actually, he was responding to a call of nature.
Chet Huntley, you covered the Bandung Conference, I believe, and there the... you did, didn't you?
Yes, that's
and,
right.
And there are the Asian-African nations banded together and expressed great interest in the United Nations. Do you feel that that the Bandung influence is going to be felt more and more in the United Nations, in that the Asian-African groups, nations become a block or a group?
I believe there's no such thing as a bloc of Asian African nations. That was demonstrated very quickly and rather emphatically at Bandung. However, I think we're already feeling the influence, some influence of Bandung, by the very fact that this commemorative conference is underway. Because I think Bandung did start a bit of a thaw. There was Joe's magnanimous sounding statement, which he said he would like to talk about Formosa. Mm-hmm. And then it set off a whole assortment of visitations with special on the part of special ambassadors and heads of states and whatnot. So I think there is a bit of a thaw, and that created more interest in this very conference that's opening here today. And as you say, the United Nations was mentioned time and time and time again in that final communique from the Bandung Conference. As a matter of fact, every question that wasn't resolved at Bandung was thrown back to the United Nations.
In other words, it shows what you said a little while ago, that the UN is getting greater acceptability. Now, we're talking about greater acceptability in this connection outside the United States. But I think it's interesting that suddenly there seems to be greater acceptability of the United Nations inside the United States. There was a period a few years ago when this wasn't true. How would you evaluate what seems to be a change in public opinion, Bill Henry?
Well, I think that in all probability, Pauline, the same people who were violently opposed to the United Nations 10 years ago are still just as violently opposed, if not more so. I think that it is a group that I don't think we have any very large groups one way or the other in this country. I think that it's a very vociferous group which is very, very much opposed to practically everything that the United Nations does. There are other groups which are probably just as large, maybe larger, who are violently in favor of the United Nations. But I have felt all along that the great percentage of the American people are willing to take or leave the United Nations depending on its ability to perform. They all hope that it's going to be good. They don't feel they can do very much about it, but they're waiting for the United Nations to make good, and it seems to me that's the opinion of the average American.
Of course, the curious thing is that there are two violent groups in this country with reference to the United Nations, both of which are, in a sense, opposed to it. There is the group of the arch-isolationists, who feel that this is an organization in which the United States is always going to be victimized, in which we would do much better if we were alone, acting on our own, and not subject to the vetoes and the controls that are naturally exercised by a universal body. That's one group, the ultra-Americans, isolationists, I think is the best way to characterize. And the other is the one-worlder group, the people that feel that the United Nations is too weak. They want an organization that takes away sovereignty from every one of its members and that vests that sovereignty in a great one-world organization. Well, they're both wrong. They're both extreme. They both represent an impossible ideal. And the United Nations, which is between them, represents the possibility of practical achievement. And I do think, as you suggest, that more and more Americans are coming to realize that, coming to realize the wrongness of isolation for the leading world power which we are today, and the wrongness of attempting to go faster than human conscience and human experience will permit.
Pauline, speaking of Southeast Asia, I saw something there a few weeks ago, repeatedly so, which at least indicates a development which we did not foresee here, I think, in 1945. I doubt whether the Indians and the Indonesians and Burmese and Thais and whatnot are too well acquainted with the General Assembly or the Security Council. But the specialized agencies are the ones that count in that part of the world. And millions of people out there know very definitely what UNICEF is, and the World Health Organization, and the Food and Agricultural Organization. And it's these specialized agencies that have bolstered the prestige of the United Nations in that part of the world tremendously so.
And they're all much more powerful than similar organizations under the League of Nations. There's been a tremendous development in the humanitarian work of the world body.
And done it very quietly, without
very quietly,
without
and very
dramatics.
Effectively. Yeah. And as you travel around the world, I've gone around twice within recent years, I have found that everywhere this work is proceeding under the direction of United Nations experts who know their work, who are doing it in the right way. And that, I think, is one of the great contributions.
Well, I think everybody realizes that these are the problems that make or break war. And if people get an opportunity,
economics.
If they get food, if they get liberty, if they get freedom, if they get these various other things, and those are the things that are done or looked after by the specialized agency, there won't be any problem of war.
Well, I'm awfully glad that Chet started this discussion of the broader aspects of the United Nations, because certainly these specialized agencies are laying the true foundation for peace. Now, if we can just get a sufficiently long armistice in the political disputes, maybe we'll have a chance for permanent peace to grow. Just, yes, Hans.
I just want to say this, that fundamentally, the thing that strengthens the United Nations way and beyond anything that the League of Nations could ever accomplish is the fact that the United States was a member from the beginning and is devoting itself wholeheartedly to United Nations work. That the League didn't have. The League had this handicap too, that it was tied in with the treaties of peace. The United Nations has nothing to do with the treaties of peace.
Yeah.
It's entirely separate from it. It is really an organization of peoples as against an organization of states.
And that is the important thing, and I think we all have expressed today hope that the United Nations is heading along the right road and that it will eventually achieve the purposes for which it's founded. Thank you very much, Mr. H.V. Kaltenborn, Mr. Bill Henry, Mr. Chet Huntley. This is Pauline Frederick. Join us again tomorrow at this time for another report on the 10th anniversary meeting of the United Nations, direct from the War Memorial Opera House in San Francisco.
Keep tuned to this NBC spot on your radio dial for the best in music, drama, comedy, and news. This is the NBC Radio Network.